Certain information set forth in the podcast may contain forward-looking statements under applicable security laws. These statements are not guarantees of future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Although forward-looking statements contained in this presentation are based upon what management of the company believes to be reasonable assumptions, there can be no assurance that forward-looking statements will prove to be accurate. LifeSci Advisors and the company undertake no obligation to update forward-looking statements in the podcast should circumstances or management's estimates or opinions change. This podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not an offer or solicitation to buy securities and does not constitute investment advice.
So the reason to combine the drugs at the same time is not to wait for the patient to fail venetoclax and then intervene with a new drug. Rather, suppress both proteins at the same time, a phenomenon which sometimes is called double hit, which means that the cancer cell has fewer ways to escape and is led to apoptosis more efficiently, which means we can capture more cells and hopefully eventually change the course of disease and give the patient longer survival.
Hello, my name is Neil Canavan, and this is Benchtop Bios, a podcast series by LifeSci Partners where we introduce healthcare investors to the people and the pipelines driving the biotech sector forward. My guest today is Spiro Rombotis. He is the president and CEO of Cyclacel Pharmaceuticals. Spiro, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Neil.
All right, so first things first, let's get started with the elevator pitch for your company. Where is Cyclacel Pharmaceuticals headquartered? How long have you been in business, and what sort of business are you in?
We are headquartered in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, which is about half an hour west of New York City. We've been in business for about 2 decades, and we are focused on cancer drugs, especially cancer drugs that affect the cell cycle, which is how the company's name was derived.
Splendid. All right, we're going to get a much deeper drill down on the science in just a minute, but first, we need to talk about the mission of Benchtop Bios, which is to learn more about the people who are in charge of these companies. So, Spiro, I'm going to start right at the beginning. I'm going to guess you're not from Texas. Sir, where were you born?
In Athens, Greece.
In Athens, Greece.
We do have a drawl there.
All right. I've heard of Athens. I've seen a few pictures. Sadly, I've not been there as yet. We can talk about that later. But all right. So you're in this extraordinary classical place. Tell me about that young man. You have interest in history. You have hobbies. You have something special in mind when you want to grow up. What about this kid?
Well, I was actually interested in traveling and seeing the world, but I hadn't found my calling yet. My father, however, was in a business, in a small business, serving the medical profession, primarily veterinarians, dentists, government research labs, and so on. So from early life, I became exposed to physicians, and I got fascinated by what they do in trying to help people. So that gave me a directional signal to go after, which was to be in healthcare.
All right. So this kid goes off to high school, which is called Athens College. This was a Greek American high school. You were class of 77, valedictorian, nicely done. You then cross the pond to attend Williams College, which is absolutely nothing like Athens. This is in Williamstown, Massachusetts. You majored in economics and sociology, class of 81. All right. So 3 questions. Why leave Greece? Why Williams? Why economics and sociology?
But I was offered a full scholarship to go to Williams College, which is an exceptional academic, world-renowned institution, and also had some links to certain individuals in the placement office at Athens College, which made it a bit more palatable, as I realized that would be in winter conditions for 6 months of the year, which is for a young person rather new if you come from the Mediterranean. But of course, the academics were exceptional. There were teachers in the classroom that I have not met before who were very gifted, very committed to their cause, and it was a life-changing experience. Economics and sociology was probably a combination of my interests at the time. I wanted to understand how capitalism works. Resources get allocated by a society to discover useful things, medicines being a good example of that. And sociology, because I was fascinated by the human condition, particularly the sociology of work. I had some very gifted professors who imbued even more interest and excitement in pursuing that field to understand humanity.
I have to ask you, do you remember your first snow?
Oh, yeah. It was one of the biggest snowstorm blizzards in the Northeast in the late 70s, which meant that the dorm where I was living in was blocked and not plowed for several weeks. I mean, I had to plow through the snow, literally, to wade through the snow to go to classrooms.
Oh,
and on
my
the way
God.
Back in the evening, it was something else.
Did you enjoy it?
Well, it was something, it was an adventure. It was nevertheless a challenge at the time, as I'm not familiar with winter conditions of that severity.
Okay, so you leave the snowbanks and you head to Wall Street, which is not quite as cold, at least not outside. You got a position in investment at First Boston. How did this come about?
Well, 200 applications, one interview, one offer, literally.
Wow. And so tell me a little bit about your life there on Wall Street. You were there for a couple of years.
Yeah, it was a bit of the boiler environment that the investment banks put young analysts through. It was, however, a fantastic experience to get a very rapid introduction to the world of business across many industries. Shallow when it comes to understanding the industries, but very relevant when it comes to understanding how they get financed. And then I was selected to go a floor up at the mergers and acquisitions department, where, of course, we're involved in the business of either defending clients from hostile offers or pursuing friendly deals, which was also a huge learning experience with the vertical curve. It was an environment that also exposed me to healthcare. In fact, with two other colleagues who are higher ranked than I was, an associate and a vice president, we started a healthcare team and did about 40 transactions in the healthcare space, which cemented my interest to go into this field professionally after my MBA.
You just mentioned your MBA. Part of that training was also through Novartis?
Well, Novartis was the internship between the first and second year of the MBA.
I see.
I went to Basel, Switzerland, where I interned in the business development department of the corporation. It was then called Ciba Geigy, subsequently Novartis, one of the world's top pharmaceutical companies to this day.
All right, so I would mention the MBA had a focus in international finance and hospitals, so you've now merged these two interests, and then you moved on to the business world. And in 1985, that meant taking the position of corporate development at Centocor. This is now part of J&J in Pennsylvania. Then a year and a half later, you moved to the European headquarters in Netherlands, where you're head of European marketing. Tell me about that.
Well, Centocor was a startup. I had just come out of the University of Pennsylvania incubator when I joined. I was employee number 9. We had cash for a few weeks and nothing in the clinic. It was an extraordinary experience.
Wow.
It took a lot of courage to accept the career risks involved with that. It was, I think, one of the 4 or maybe 5 biotechs that existed in the United States or in the world at that time.
Yeah.
And therefore a pioneer. The field we were in was very exciting, was the field of monoclonal antibodies, which is today a $100 billion industry growing at an exponential rate, serving many unmet medical needs in different disease spectra. But at that time, I was regularly thrown out of hospitals, trying to persuade doctors to do clinical trials with our drugs, particularly after I moved in Europe, because of the fear that this unknown modality would cause toxicity in patients. Particularly because part of the antibodies were derived from mice, or murine, as we say.
Yeah.
So after a few minutes of attempted persuasion, when the doctor says, you know, I have other business to deliver, says, but sir, our data shows, young man out. So I'm very, I guess, happy to say that this field persisted. It was very valuable. We were the first company in the world to test antibodies for cancer and inflammatory diseases and brought 2 drugs to market, which ultimately catalyzed the J&J acquisition in the late 80s.
So I have to ask you, so you had experience in the States and then you went off to the Netherlands. Obviously, you're from Greece. When you were running a team overseas, putting things together, did you have to be mindful of the culture? Like, okay, this is different. Like, no one's going to show up in August. Were there differences in how you handled people?
Yeah, there are. I mean, the August is more of a Southern European thing around the French, but the Dutch have also their persistent habits. And of course, I had to learn the language. I took a crash course over a week and learned enough to be dangerous.
Oh my God.
Also found it necessary to understand the philosophy. I mean, if you go to a cheese shop that closes at 5 o'clock and you go there 4:45, you buy a head of cheese, the attendant will tell you, sorry, I've just closed up and wrapped everything up. Come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
that wouldn't happen in the States, right?
No.
Or anywhere else. But that's the Dutch psyche. And of course, the lights were up in the building late in the evening and I would field phone calls from colleagues, spouses who were concerned. And I said, look, we didn't ask your spouse to stay in the office they chose to. They're free agents.
Oh, no.
What they were doing was so exciting that they didn't want to go home just yet. And of course, the other bit that was important was to understand local cultural sensitivities. We were a foreign company who put this space age factory in the middle of an academic district in the University of Leiden area. We were the first company to build what is now a huge science park with tens of thousands of employees. People hadn't connected the two. That our arrival there signaled the beginning of a new era of employment, wealth creation, and prosperity for the area. Today, it's about medical hub of consequence in the whole of Europe. So being the first always carries those risks and sometimes a local reaction, but we persisted.
All right. This sounds extremely exciting, rewarding, et cetera, but you left in 88 to go to BMS and come back to the States. Was it a family decision? Like, why?
it was a family decision in part. The other part was that I was recruited by what was then Squibb to run the international part of one of their divisions, primarily because of my Senecor experience, having established, built, and grown a local business in a foreign country. They wanted to do something around the same. They had one of the most important drugs of the corporation, which was turning over $500 million in the early 90s. And they hadn't sold a penny outside the U.S. So my job was to build operations around the world and do clinical trials and supervise those and hopefully bring those drugs to market, which was successful, particularly for a drug for brain cancer, for differential diagnosis of brain tumors.
So this is all in the oncology space, your responsibilities?
It was mostly in the oncology space. That's right.
Okay.
Bristol Myers Squibb at that time was one of the world's leaders in the space of oncology, which it remains to this day.
Mm. All right, so you moved on from there in 1999. You signed on for something called a Liposome Company. This is also an oncology-focused, conveniently located where you were in Princeton. You were the VP of International Operations and BD for 4 years there before coming on board at Cyclacel in 1997, where you work to this day. Serge, a quick bit of math, that's roughly 25 years. You really, really, really like this company. Why?
Well, after a total career of 37 years, spending 20 plus in another company, you're correct, is either a sign of being an incurable romantic or that is really exciting. And I think it's the latter. This is a company which in itself is a pioneer. Just like Centocor was in the antibody field 20 years before, Cyclacel is a pioneer in the area of cell cycle biology. In fact, a couple of years after the company was started, I was the first CEO, together with the professor, the academic who was the founder of the company. The Nobel Prize was awarded in 2001 for the very field the company is pursuing, the field of CDK inhibitors or cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors. So this is an important field, but it took forever to gestate. It was sitting on the runway for more than two decades. And finally, a few years ago, the first drug from this category came to market.
Yeah.
Now we're in a very exciting period in the company's history where the leader of a pack of companies trying to drug another facet of the same mechanism. And this is an exciting year for us as our first data is starting to come out.
All right, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about Cyclacel and the assets. Now, in your deck, it states your mission very clearly and concisely, and that is to enable the phenomena of apoptosis. And I'm going to just take the initiative here to point out that this comes from a Greek word, and it describes the falling of leaves off trees or petals off flowers, a very natural process. Well, multicelled organisms also do this when they get rid of cells that don't work or they're just old. And Cyclacel would like to take advantage of this phenomena to kill tumors. And we're going to do this by way of a drug called fadraciclib or Fadra, a drug that inhibits CDK2 and CDK9. Spiro, what's the mechanism here that causes apoptosis?
Well, you explained it very articulately. I think you did a great job. The only difference is that we do not aspire to kill cells as we do with chemotherapy, where the goal of the drug is to poison those cells, hopefully poison normal cells to a lesser degree, end up in a positive balance for the patient. In the context of apoptosis induction or enablement, which is how this class works, we want to enable the body's own mechanism, as you pointed out, that weeds out dangerous cells. This was actually the citation of the Nobel Prize award in part for how a process called cell cycle checkpoint control works. Everybody has heard about checkpoint control. There is immune checkpoint control, but there's also cell cycle checkpoint control. Effectively, the cells are checked at two major transitions to the body clock of the cell cycle for damage in the DNA. If the damage is irreparable, not possible to repair, then they're instructed to commit suicide, leave the cell cycle, and commit to apoptosis. So this is a process by which we induce the cells to get weeded out or indirectly led to suicide by the immune system. And the goal is to do so at a dose which is not toxic or not less toxic than normal cells that might be in chemotherapy. So essentially, what we're trying to do is restore a mechanism which was lost due to mutation or some other phenomenon that happens to afflict cancer patients, where in a normal human being, exactly as you pointed out, our hair or our nails do not grow forever. At some point, they stop growing. At some point, they fall off. That is regulated by apoptosis and cell cycle. In cancer, the molecular breaks that stop this process misfunction or are deleted. And our goal is to re-enable them.
All right. Now you've completed phase testing with Fadra. You saw single agent activity as well as activity in combination with venetoclax. I'm a little confused about this. There were two separate patient populations?
Yes. We did single agent testing in people with solid cancers ovarian, breast, colorectal, and so on. And we did combination testing with the drug venetoclax, as you point out, in leukemias. And the reason, of course, for this is that venetoclax addresses a protein which is notorious, and it's the only approved drug by the FDA that enables apoptosis. This protein is called BCL2, and when patients fail venetoclax, another protein is upregulated or elevated in its expression called MCL1, and that is addressed by Fadra. So the reason to combine the drugs at the same time is not to wait for the patient to fail venetoclax and then intervene with a new drug, rather suppress both proteins at the same time, a phenomenon which sometimes is called a double hit, which means that the cancer cell has fewer ways to escape and is led to apoptosis more efficiently, which means we can capture more cells and hopefully eventually change the course of disease and give the patient longer survival.
You've mentioned a couple of molecular targets here, BCL2, for instance. How did you enroll patients? Are there biomarkers here?
There are biomarkers here, not BCL2, that's the venetoclax target, but MCL1, which is the target of our drug, Fadra. Another sister protein to MCL1, which is called MYC, M-Y-C. It's an oncoprotein. It's a driver for cancer. And then these are germane to the CDK9 part of our target profile. And then cyclin E, another oncoprotein or a cancer gene that drives primarily women's cancers, is known to be very active, among others, but also in breast, ovarian, endometrial, and uterine cancer. Oftentimes, patients, when they progress on existing approved CDK inhibitors, particularly with breast cancer, are found to have elevation of the cyclin E protein. So a drug that can hit CDK2 and CDK9 can address a very broad spectrum of human cancers, not only solid, but also liquid cancers.
Okay, that explains the two different populations. All right, now, as I said, that we have the preclinical testing in hand. You have the phase 1 in hand. Did you see any safety signals?
We have not, which is kind of remarkable because the history of this class is buffeted with myelosuppression and other toxicities of the bone marrow, and sometimes what we call off-target toxicities. Mm. On target, though, one would expect to see myelosuppression if one was to dose the drug close to the maximally tolerated dose. Of course, some of the theory here, which the professor who founded Cyclacel taught many years ago, which is what attracted me to this field, is that it's possible with the right drug that one could induce those cells to commit suicide by apoptosis without hitting toxicity or by having a lot less. And that appears to be the nut that we cracked with fadracycline, with Fadra, because we have found a dose range in which we can see single agent activity. No other drug is given to these patients who are highly refractory, almost at the end of their tether, very close to hospice care or death. And they go into these phase 1 trials, and then we see, lo and behold, single agent activity, which is not part of the script, neither because these patients are very heavily pretreated, they have failed 6, maybe 7 lines of therapy, nor in this class, where the phenomenon of single agent activity is extremely rare. But we've seen this in multiple patients without toxicities, such that we exhausted the 5 dose levels that were allowed to test the drug by the FDA. We went back to the FDA, filed an amendment. We're not testing 2 levels above that because we still haven't hit toxicity. And to move to phase 2, typically you need to do so and declare the dose below the toxic level as the recommended dose of phase 2. Here we're seeing encouraging activity. Patients can take the drug for a long time. Some have exceeded 1 year of therapy. There's one patient actually who's now in her 3rd year of treatment on just Fadra alone, which means that they can be given very tolerably. So we're in a very happy place, safe drug, given by a mouth, and active. The next challenge, of course, to find which tumors and then to enrich with biomarkers, as you pointed out.
Okay, point of confusion. In the deck, it refers to an IV formulation. You just mentioned the oral. When did that happen?
Well, we started with an IV drug for many reasons. First of all, when we give the drugs intravenously, they become available systemically almost instantly. When we give them by a mouth, they may get blocked in the gut. They may take time to metabolize, and therefore we may only reach a small proportion of the ingested material to the tissue of interest, which is the tumor. The other reason for testing IV drugs is that we know that the patients will take the medicine, right? Phase 1 patients tend to have many other conditions. They're not very motivated after a few weeks to stay on study unless there's a spectacular result. And as a consequence, they oftentimes will chuck the pills down the toilet. With IV drugs, you know the drug failed or succeeded because the patients took it. So the pandemic then struck in late 2019, early 2020, and it became clear that our alternative program, which is a few months behind, which is the oral version of the same drug, was a necessity. People would not go to the clinic and be exposed to the virus because they have an immunocompromised environment. Cancer patients are known to have higher mortality on COVID disease, And therefore, it became imperative to switch the whole program, actually for both of our drugs, to oral, which there was also additional biological reasons to do that. But at the time, we had the first human data, became a sort of no-brainer decision to switch everything to oral.
Well, I congratulate you on that pivot of strategy. So now you're enrolling for your phase 1-2 testing with Fadra. What's the protocol and the patient population? Are we going to do the single agent and combo again?
Well, yeah. I mean, at this point, we're just doing single agent. The playbook was to do both, as you correctly point out, but we were somewhat surprised to see single agent activity in multiple patients. This is not part of what you expect in this class. Normally, you have to give these drugs in combination. That's the history anyway. Fadra is writing the book and raising the bar for other competitors in this space. And that's exciting for us. It also is exciting for patients. If we consider that the investigators, the physicians in the clinic, are proxies or ambassadors for the patients, their excitement and desire to join this study is a very good indicator that we are serving patients in this phase one environment. The other bit that is very interesting for us is that we're at the field now that the competition is somewhat disparate and somewhat diverse. There's no one company with a drug that hits both CDK2 and CDK9. They either hit 9 or they hit 2. Mm-hmm. Some of these drugs are given IV, and we've done the experiment. Giving the drug IV is not optimal biologically. Giving it orally, primarily every day, is very important. And finally, we're getting these results that now point to phase 2, which is part of the same trial. As you pointed out, there's a phase/2 study, meaning that we can seamlessly move within the same protocol from phase 1 to phase 2 once we finish our dose work, which is now almost at the final stretch.
You mentioned competitors. We don't actually have to name them, but in the deck, you do emphasize the half-life of your drug. How is this relevant?
Well, it's very important because the life of the proteins we like to suppress, MCL1, cyclin, and so on, is very short. It's a few hours. So of no benefit to give a drug that will lie around for 24 hours or longer in the bloodstream if all we want is to suppress a protein which will be around for 4 or 5 hours. So we need to have a half-life around less than half a day. Fadra is even better than that. We can give it twice a day without toxicity, which means that we can suppress the proteins twice in a 24-hour window rather than suppress them once the drug goes away and then they come back. Or worse, we have to give the drug continuously, such as with an IV infusion, then we just add toxicity. We don't add more efficacy. Mm-hmm. So it is, in our opinion, and I think others are coming to realize that now based on scientific announcements, that short half-life is a virtue in this class, given that the targets are also short-lived.
All right, got it. When can we expect some data from the phase 1-2?
Well, we just announced that we have submitted our phase 1 data for publication in a major scientific meeting in cancer about a month and a half away, and we'll soon be able to declare whether we have the abstract accepted. We are very excited about this opportunity to report our data, particularly the spectrum of disease in which we're seeing anti-cancer activity with the drug as a single agent. And then we expect to hold an R&D day shortly thereafter, where we expect to give a lot more detail, both on Fadra and our other drug, 140.
Are we talking about ASH? What are we talking about?
No, ASH is a hematology meeting. This is a meeting for solid cancers. The activity we've seen so far has been exclusively in multiple types of solid tumors and some lymphomas. Lymphoma is a disease that sometimes is classified as a liquid cancer, sometimes as a solid tumor. It looks like a solid tumor, but is really a liquid, but it's certainly an area of huge unmet medical need with high differentiation. And we need more medicines for these patients.
All right. Well, I look forward to that presentation. Hopefully I can be in the room. All right. So let's move on. We have a second asset to discuss. This is a little earlier. It's CLC-140. This is a PLK1 inhibitor and has completed preclinical testing. So Spiro, let's really simply, what's PLK1 and why do you want to inhibit it?
Right. So PLK1 was discovered by Cyclocel's chief scientist, Professor David Glover, who was also at the time the chairman of genetics in the University of Cambridge in England. Cyclocel is a UK Anglo-American company. Effectively, PLK is the master regulator of the last stage of the cell cycle. Whereas the early work with CDKs is in the early cell cycle checkpoints, the last stage in this body clock is a field called mitosis. Mitosis is when the cells divide and the parent cell actually divides its nuclear material and other parts of the cellular machinery to daughter cells. This process happens along this elongated spindle. Think of this as a fuselage of an aircraft, where on the front of the aircraft is one cell, on the tail is the other cell. Eventually, the cells pull apart, the material is divided, and two daughter cells proliferate. In cancer, this otherwise normal process becomes degenerate, and the cells divide out of control, leading to eventually overwhelming the patient and cancer-related death or other misery. So the goal of mitotic regulation with PLK1 is to observe the huge advantage that David Glover and other people in his field have discovered. This is the scientist who discovered this field and our chief scientist, that PLK1 loss is lethal to cancer cells, whereas normal cells can survive loss of PLK1 and then can go back into cycle when the drug effect wears off. Once again, here we want to enable apoptosis, the natural process to weed out dangerous cells by denying PLK1 to cancer cells, but we also want to spare normal cells toxicity. So again, identifying the right dose is critical. Mm. We opened a phase one trial 8 months ago. We've now enrolled six patients. We're escalating to different dose levels. And although we're dosing very low and it's very provocative, we find it intriguing that two of these patients have had already 5 and 6 cycles respectively of treatment, almost 5 and 6 months on therapy. These are heavily pretreated patients at a dose that we thought preclinically would be inactive. But we are seeing some activity. The big question is why. So we're intensively now interrogating both biomarkers and the molecular mechanisms to understand why we may be seeing this early index of activity. Ultimately, PLK1 will have utility both in solid tumors, and there is some evidence from one other company in this field that this could be particularly true for colon cancer, but also in other fields, in leukemia as well, thanks to an older drug, which was given intravenously but had some toxicity issues, but worked very well in leukemia, but perhaps didn't succeed because of its long half-life and extensive toxicity. So we hope that, again, with FADRA 140 will also be useful in both solid tumors and leukemia, and our program is designed to address that. But it's about a year and a half to 2 years behind FADRA at this point.
So you sort of hinted at perhaps a tumor type has emerged from your testing so far as the best hit?
Well, it's really hard to tell because PLK is highly preserved in human evolution and it's relevant to many tumor types. So we try not to be biased. I think being an objective scientist, one has to always fight biases and look at the data with a cold towel over one's head and understand what it tells. I think PLK1 may be more relevant in certain tumors than others. That's no doubt the case. Our job is to find it. For this reason, the phase two part of our study, again with 140, we're doing a similar design to FADRA, has 8 different tumor types, 8 different histologies selected for relevance to this mechanism and or preclinical data supporting that. Interestingly, in the last few months, many of the investigators who are now joining the trial as trialists have done preclinical work with cancer specimens obtained from their patients in the clinic, in the laboratory, where they expose those harvested cells from patients to 140 and seeing activity. And that has greatly encouraged our choice of tumor types in the phase two portion of the study. So we're very anxious to find the dose and then move to phase two. We can test the hypothesis in large numbers of patients with relevant cancers. And we can certainly talk a bit about what those are, but they range from bladder cancer and colon cancer all the way to lung and breast tumors that are known to become very sensitive when PLK1 is inhibited.
If your PLK1 inhibitor shows efficacy in tumor type X and tumor type X also comes up with FADRA, would it make sense to think about a combination?
Yes, that's a very interesting question that you raise. We have seen early preclinical evidence of synergy with these two drugs. One member works in the early stage of the cell cycle, the other one in the very last stage, so your question is very apt. We call this sequencing. How do we sequence two drugs that work in subsequent stages of a biological phenomenon is a great challenge in cancer pharmacology. We don't want to get the sequence wrong because we may annul the activity of a drug, which would harm patients, not help them. So it's very important to be disciplined. First, establish single agent activity and then go into combinations. The FDA has been incredibly, in my opinion, innovative in regulatory science in the last few years. They are willing to consider two unapproved drugs together.
Yeah.
But the data has to be extraordinary in early development to justify that. So from a point of view of both risk management as well as getting what I call a very clear, not confusing signal, is best to establish first robustly single agent activity and then go on and study combinations where the need to separate which drug does what is a much more complex biological question.
All right, I'm going to wrap up soon. I have 3 more questions. This is mostly related to the business risk. Let's talk about competitors for this drug. We already talked about FADRA. PLK1 has competitors as well. And how are you positioning that?
There's only one company competing with us in this field. They're another small company like us. They in-licensed their drug from an Italian drug development group that discovered their PLK1. Both they and Cyclacel have the same objective. We were trying to imitate that proto-molecule in this area. This is a compound developed by a large German pharmaceutical company that had the activity in leukemia I mentioned earlier. That molecule had 2 major liabilities. possibly one could say fatal liabilities. One was that it had a very long half-life, over 3 days. So we couldn't turn this drug off. It was there the whole time, possibly doing more damage than good. The other one was given intravenously, which we know is okay in leukemia, because disease of the body throughout the bloodstream. Whereas if you want to localize the activity in a tumor, the oral route is much better. And now, of course, in the immediate post-pandemic era, this is an absolute necessity. People vote with their feet and they won't show up easily for IV trials. So both the Italian group and we were successful in designing drugs that were improvements over the German initial compound in this class of therapeutics. Their compound is much shorter than the German one, about 24 hours half-life. Ours is even better, about 11. We think we have the best in class molecule as far as half-life is concerned. Thereafter, there are some differences in how these compounds work. They both hit PLK1 with almost identical potency, but the secondary and tertiary targets are a bit different. And they have some other differences that we will discuss in the R&D day that's coming up later this fall. Essentially, though, we both believe that PLK1 is a valid target. This is a field that was abandoned by many drug companies many years ago because of the failure of the German firm to bring the drug to market. And now we're seeing a huge level of interest, again, arising in this field. And there are only two players, Cyclocell and our other colleagues in the West Coast. So it's going to be a very exciting 1-2 race to see whether we can reach the market with either or both of these drugs. And it's very plausible that we'll not necessarily pursue the same strategy because of fundamental differences in how this drug's biology works.
Okay, and now a question for the lawyers. Where's the IP for all this?
Well, the IP is domiciled in the UK. Remember that this is a company started in the UK. I actually moved to the United Kingdom for many years. And we have had the early discoveries done then when the company was strictly a UK limited company before we established a US office and built our headquarters here. So for many years, we were actually domiciled in the UK and we remain to this day, which has advantages for the intellectual property as there are both legislative and tax advantages to have your patents listed in the UK first, as well as the fact that we get a very large rebate from Her Majesty's government every year for R&D spent anywhere in the world. It's an R&D tax credit, which actually paid in cash every year for expenses made in high-tech businesses with small employee headcounts like Cyclocell. So there are many advantages to maintain this Anglo-American structure of the company, but clearly the world's best capital markets and some of the world's best hospitals are in the United States, so it's very important to have a foot in both sides of the pond.
All right, and now let's finally talk more directly about that cash. What sort of runway are we looking at, and what sort of conversations would you like to have with investors during your R&D day?
Well, at the moment, we project cash a bit over 1 year from now. This is based on forecasts where all programs that we have allocated get fully funded. Obviously, we're traversing an extremely challenging time in the biotech industry. I've been in the industry long enough, over 30 years, I've seen 3 or 4 of these cycles. I can't say if one is worse or better. They're all bad because capital becomes scarce. And as the cost of capital rises, people tend to allocate their portfolios to less risky investments. But there's one fundamental, if you want, counter-cyclical argument to life sciences. Regardless of what the business cycle is, people need medicines. And we know that after the pandemic, societies, the very wide range of human activity are now focused on healthcare and provision of healthcare in economical ways. Medicines is the most cost-efficient approach to healthcare. Far cheaper to take a medicine that can keep you out of hospital than get into hospital and have supportive care, even if you didn't even treat the underlying symptoms. So the goal here is to discover medicines that provide value, that are novel, and have exclusivity. And I think we hit all of those. And therefore, I think investors will become very much aware of the scarcity value of both Fadra 140. Fadra is the leader. And being one or two in this business, of course, as Jack Welch said many years ago, it's extremely important. You cannot be first or second without a first mover advantage or second, but with a differentiated mechanism. Maybe shouldn't be in this business at all. And we're very proud to point out to investors that both of our drugs, either first or second, have important, but we think, advantages to other drugs in the space. And as we're now starting to roll out with clinical data, I think we can document that with facts. So I think based on unsolicited input into the company and discussions with investors, there's a lot of interest in what we do, and hopefully we'll be able to secure further capital to pursue our program to an eventual proof of concept.
There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. That is a wrap. My guest today is Spiro Rombotis. He is the president and CEO of Cyclocell Pharmaceutical. Spiro, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's Benchtop Bios.
I hope that this episode will serve as yet another data point to guide you in your investment strategies. If you wish to hear more of LifeSci's benchtop bios, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Google. Also, if there's a company or a particular executive you'd like to get to know, I do take requests. Please send those to ncanada@lifesciadvisors.com. Until next week, then, goodbye, or for that matter, good sell, whatever boosts your portfolio.